Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And today, we are here to talk about a board game.
Wouldn't you know it?
Sometimes we talk about concepts. Today, we got a game on our hands. And sort of a banger of a game, in my opinion. It was pretty fun to play. I obtained this game recently, and we've had some fun playing it with various groups of people, being our family members. It's great. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We're talking about Waveling, designed by Alex Hogg, Justin Vickers, and Wolfgang Warsch, and published in 2019 by Palm Court Games. And it won the Golden Geek Best Party Game Award for 2019.
All right.
It is, after all, a party game.
Yeah, so just to give a short description. Oh, I want to give a special shout out to product design by Sarah Pavis, who did an excellent job with the components in this game. So the game's called Wavelength. For a short description of Wavelength, players divide into two teams and take turns being their team's psychic, whose goal is to get their team to guess a secret location on a given spectrum with a clever clue. At the start of every turn, the psychic randomizes a wheel that selects where a target wedge on a dial is located, then draws a card that denotes the ends of a spectrum, such as good to evil, and then peeks at the target location on the spectrum before hiding it and coming up with a clue. Then the psychic hands the dial to their team, who turns a hand to the position on the dial that they believe the clue is indicating. For example, Captain America might be all the way on the good end, Thanos on the evil end, and Deadpool somewhere in the middle. So depending on where the target wedge is on that dial, you would choose an appropriate clue and give it to your team, and your team would move the hand to where they think the clue is directing them. After the guess is locked in, the psychic reveals the target location. If the guess was dead on, the team earns 4 points, but if it was close, the team could earn 2 or 3 points, depending on how close they were. Teams and players take turns as the psychic until one team reaches 10 points and is declared the winner. So I think a big part of understanding how this game is played and what it's about is to understand what the component looks like, because there's one very big component that you use to play this game. It is a wheel that is sitting on a stand with a window built into the wheel's, you know, holding mechanism that will show half of the wheel at any given time. And then on the wheel that is inside this mechanism, there is printed a small wedge where in the very center of this wedge is like a 4-point slice, and then on either side of that are 2 3-point slices, and then either side of that are 2 2-point slices. So you cover up this window with this little handle mechanism thing to hide where that wedge is. The psychic gets to see where it is, and then they draw a card, and so the card will tell you, like, on the far left of this spectrum, you know, half-circle dial thing, the far left, what that side means, far right, what that side means, and as the psychic, you have to give a clue to help your team guess where on that dial your wedge is located.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I gave that example of, like, good to evil, and I used, like, comic book characters as an example, but you can kind of go wherever you want with the clue. So that's how the game is played. So we'll get a little bit more into the gameplay and strategy, and then later on we're going to talk about the design of the game. So where would you like to start, Matthew?
Well, I wanted to note that the wedge that you mentioned is roughly the size of 1/8 of the wheel, maybe 1/6, somewhere between there, with the 4-point always has to be visible on the dial, the wheel itself. Yes. So if you randomize it and the 4-point space is not visible, then you have to do it again.
Yeah. So there's two of these that are on either side of this wheel. So no matter how much you spin it, you're always going to be able to see this wedge. But yeah, there's the times when the 4-point could be, like, cut off halfway on the far end of one of this like half circle that you see visible.
However, you don't need the entire wedge visible. So you could have the 2 points or even the 3-point part like hidden off the bottom, as long as the 4-point space is there.
Right. So like I mentioned, there's this window There's a green plastic thing that covers up the window so you can't see. It hides where the wedge is. You start with the window closed when you randomize where your wedge is going to be when it's your turn as a psychic. And then you open it up quickly just to see where that wedge is, and you close it again. And you don't open it again until your team has locked in their guess for your clue.
Mm-hmm. Also, I believe it has like room for 10 points on the point tracker.
Yes.
Each team has a point tracker. There's two teams, two point trackers. That goes by super quickly sometimes.
Yeah. When we get into design, we can talk about sort of how fast games can go.
But I think for
the team that goes first starts with 0 points, it's worth mentioning. And the team that goes second starts with 1 point.
I honestly think if you're playing it with whoever, just like ignore the point system. Or don't restart when you hit the end.
Sure.
I think it's fun to keep track of points for like accuracy, but it'll break up the pacing a lot if you just end it immediately when you get to the last amount.
Right. This is the type of party game where it can be kind of up to you when you stop playing. Kind of like a game of apples to apples. You know, you can claim you win once you've, or the game ends once somebody wins 4 rounds. But you can just play as long as you want, technically.
Yeah.
The point score is a little arbitrary, but I think it's a clever use of the insert. By the way, this game, is very well contained in its box. I guess we're kind of hitting on design points. I still want to talk more about gameplay and strategy, but yeah, it uses a plastic insert to track points and to mount the, dial thing upright. There is there's a red like hand knob that you turn when it's your turn as the guessing team to indicate your guess. By the way, it's a red knob with a thin red hand that comes off of it. Hand as in like a clock's hand.
Yeah.
And you knock it, or you lock it into place, you know, anywhere on that dial, and you can pull that window screen back to reveal the answer without touching the red knob, so that the answer won't change. And when you reveal it, because the wheel that you turn and the red knob are sort of on these notched turning mechanisms, then the answer doesn't often have like a vagueness to it. Because the wheel is stuck to notches on where it can land, and the red hand is stuck to notches, it's pretty much always going to be in one of these wedges. It's never really up to debate whether the hand is resting inside the 4 point versus the 3 point, or the 3 point versus the 2 point wedge, or the 2 point versus 0 points.
Honestly, if you're able to get it between two wedges, then more power to you. That's pretty impressive.
I'm pretty sure that the notches prevent it from doing so. It's impossible to get it directly on the line. It'll always be, you know, close, but one way or the other. So this game bears a lot of resemblances to Code Names, where you're trying to get your team to guess something off of a single clue. However, in Wavelength, there are more loose guidelines for the kind of clue you can give. So the clue giving rules that the game provides are: you must be conveying a single thought. So you can't get too complicated with your answers. You can't describe a car and the environment that the car is in. You have to choose, you know, one thing or the other. It says don't invent something is another clue giving rule. You have to use existing concepts as your clues. Be on topic is another thing. So for example, being on topic, I think, mostly refers to saying something that is within the spectrum that you're given. So if the spectrum is quiet place versus loud place, then your clue can't be something that isn't a place. And then it says no synonyms, I guess meaning that if using that same example, quiet and loud, you can't use a word like quiet or quiet itself. Like you can't say, okay, a quiet place, my clue is a quiet bathroom, you know, like that. You can't say that, or you can't say a bathroom with not a lot of noise going on inside it. So no synonyms, and then no numbers. So you can't say a place with like negative decibels. I guess maybe you could, but
I think part of that is just so you can't like metagame the dial.
Yeah, sometimes like you can't metagame the dial, but you also, if you were talking about heat, maybe if cold and hot were the edges of the spectrum. You couldn't say like a 1000 Kelvin degree room, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, no numbers in the clue giving rules, but that means that you don't have to say a single word like in code names. You can say a phrase, a sentence, as long as you stay on topic and don't invent something and convey a single thought. Like for example, I had worst day of the year, best day of the year as my spectrum, and it skewed worst. So I said the day after Mardi Gras would be my idea of a skewing worst day of the year. It's not the absolute worst day of the year, but it's pretty bad. That's a single thought, and it doesn't use any numbers, and it stays on topic. It is a day.
Yeah, this is also helpful because you can use entire proper nouns.
Yes.
So, like, if you needed to name a person, which comes up pretty often, you could name their full name.
Right.
So, like I said, Jim Parsons for one of mine.
Right, exactly. So the clue-giving rules are looser than code names, which gives you a lot of flexibility. Let's see. They have some suggestions for clues, such as, like, using five words or less. So even though they allow you to say more, sometimes saying less helps keep your team on track. No qualifiers. Use proper nouns. Yeah, it suggests you to that you use proper nouns more often than not. So this game, like, it's a party game, and it's about giving good clues for your teammates. I think it's also there's an element of just trying to take a challenge at times. Using the more interesting, you're supposed to look at the spectrum card and choose. Every card is double-sided, so when you draw a card, you have two options to go with. And the game suggests that you draw your card and make your selection before you see where on the spectrum your clue is going to lead your teammates to guess. And I think that helps you to just pick something that's more interesting rather than something that's safer, especially when the clue is on one of the extremes.
Yeah,
but it's up to the psychic which side they go with. And there is a differentiation between basic cards and advanced cards. So if you want to go for a challenge, draw from the advanced card section. If not, you can play it safe with the basic cards.
There are some really awkward basic cards.
Yeah, some cards are a little awkward. You might just add a house rule that if you don't know what to say or if the spectrum either side of the card makes no sense to you, you can draw another card. Again, this is a game has plenty of room for house rules because it's not so mathed out and based on like point values and such like that, like other games. It's easy to insert your own stuff. Like, for example, last time we played, I included the rule that if one team won, but the other team was within 4 points of winning, then the other team got a shot at redemption and they would have to guess a perfect guess on like the 4 point wedge to keep the game going. But it made things a little more interesting.
Right, yeah. So, as far as clues go, I'm usually pretty bad at this, which is what I've realized.
Okay, so I have a couple tips for giving decent clues, at least with the people that I've played with. It's obviously very dependent on your playgroup, and just by playing the game, you'll come to some sort of understanding of the kinds of clues that people respond to and are able to decipher.
Or how they'll interpret your clues.
Right. So I think first thing, I always sort of subdivide or think of where the dial is in terms of like how close it is to either the edge or the center and which way it's skewing and how much it's skewing. So that'll help me sort of figure out the kind of clue that I'm trying to give. Like rather than saying I'm trying to get something at like exactly 33%, you know, from the left side, I'm thinking more like, okay, that's slightly to the left of center. A third of the way through. What's a third of the way to half? Or what's a third of the way from the center to the left? It's kind of abstract. And the way that I start to narrow it down is I think of what are the extremes in every situation. So quiet place versus loud place. A quiet place is like a sound booth or
a library. Yeah,
a library. The loudest place is like a concert or, you know, the ground zero for a missile launch or something.
Tarmac,
sure. Yeah, there's a lot of extreme. You could think of an exploding volcano, the edge of an exploding volcano.
Ooh,
I guess
Krakatoa.
You have to call it a place. Yes, the rim of Krakatoa as it explodes. That might be a little too specific for a clue, but you get the picture. So I think of the extremes, and then that helps me figure out what things might in the middle might look like. You know, if the loud can be extremely loud, then something like a concert venue seems loud, but it's not as loud as the loudest sound or the loudest place in the world, you know? So, but that's my opinion. I start with the extremes, and then when I'm thinking of the clue I'm going to give, I come up with a couple answers, and then I compare them to each other and organize them, you know, if I think of what's a quiet place versus a loud place, and I think, like, okay, there's, like, maybe it's skewing quiet, so it's not, like, a library, but it could be, like, a classroom, it could be, like, a nursery, maybe during nap time, you know, it... there's a couple different things that I might come up with, and then I organize them and I think which one is the closest to where I'm trying to get people to guess, and that's the clue I give them. Now, in addition to that, I will also consider who my teammates are and what their experience might be. So if the spectrum was about pizza toppings and I know what their pizza topping preferences are, I can use that to my advantage to give a better clue.
Yeah, I think that's another thing where as you play more, you'll kind of get better at, because I think some groups or some people tend to skew in terms of what is the psychic trying to get you to say, or basing it off the psychic's preference, and some people will skew towards what is it for the guesser's preference, you know? So, yeah. Like, the more you'll play, you'll be able to tell how much of you should put into your questions or your clues, or how much of your teammates you should try to go for.
Sure, yeah, you'll figure that as you go. And one thing as the clue guesser that you can do is think out loud with your thought process. So as the clue guesser, if you're doing the extremes scenario to figure out how close to the extremes the clue was, you could say your ideas for what the extremes are out loud to see if that maybe matched up with the clue giver. They can't acknowledge it, but they can definitely take that information and use it for a future round.
Yeah.
So you can think your process out loud. You can think about, you could say your own opinion on the clue that was given. And you can consider out loud the clue giver's opinion, whether it differs from your own. You can also talk about public opinion and maybe go off that sometimes. I think when it comes to incorporating other players' opinions, whether it's your clue guessers or whether you as the guesser are thinking about the clue giver, it generally helps when the subject is something that either person feels very about. So, like, I know that my girlfriend feels very strongly about particular actors and actresses, so I can use that information. And when I say their name, like, it's going to stick out to her in her mind. But I don't know everybody's opinion on anchovies at the table. I do know a sort of public opinion on anchovies when it comes to pizza topping. So if I don't have a good answer that's tailored to somebody that they have a very strong preference towards, I can at least use, like, something that is just kind of public knowledge, public opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are, it seems like a pretty even split of, like, opinion questions and general consensus questions, if that makes sense. Like, loud place versus quiet place is very easy to establish sort of common ground, but like overrated actor versus underrated actor, that immediately puts you in opinion space. Maybe your players will be better with one of those over the other.
Yeah, you might find out that your players are better going off of, like, a public opinion, or your players are more self-centered when it comes to their thought process, so you should play to their opinions, or your players generally think of your ideas over theirs, or your opinions over theirs, your thought process over theirs. So this is something that you just figure out as you go along, and then eventually you'll sort of get into a groove of where the clues should draw from. And it helps, again, to say your thought process out loud. It also helps, and I don't think it's against the rules, after the guess has been made and the points have been revealed, whether or not your team earned points, for the clue giver, the psychic, to just go over their thought process out loud right then and there to set up for future turns. The cards, there's so many cards that you're not going to go through repeats in, you know, a single play session. And the wedge is always randomized, so it's unlikely that you'll draw the same card and the wedge will be in the same place, so that you could give the clue that you had thought about earlier, that you discussed earlier.
Yeah.
Let's see.
I think one thing I want to bring up is, if you're unsure, don't worry about making small adjustments, because it's kind of unlikely that you'll be at a close enough distance from the wedge that you're not on it, but a tiny move will put you on it. And even then, you'll get 2 points for doing so. On the other hand, if you're nowhere near the wedge, then that tiny adjustment won't do anything.
I don't know. I'm for the tiny adjustments. I enjoy the tiny adjustments when I play this game.
I think, like, instead of one click, you should do two or three clicks at the least.
Yeah, one click might, it can only make the difference if you're directly on the border, you know, right between two, or not in between, but in one, but you're one tick away from another slice of this wedge. So, yeah, just a one tick change doesn't make big of a difference. But I don't know. I like the little micro adjustments right at the end. I don't think your first idea is always going to be the best idea.
I think it's fun to fine tune, but like when you consider the size of the wedge, it feels a little more pointless.
Yeah. After you've seen the component and you know how big each of the slices can be, I think when you make those fine tunes, you're adjusting by one or two slice widths at the minimum.
Yeah.
I like fine tuning. We did include another rule. So there is sometimes a tendency to grab the window handle that reveals the answer rather than the knob that you turn to make your selection as a guesser. There can be a tendency to go for one instead of the other and accidentally reveal a portion of the clue range. And so when that happens, I think it's we did the house rule that as long as you didn't see where the answer was and you didn't see too much of the wheel to know where it isn't, you know, or where a great deal of information of where it isn't, then you have to send it with your guess. You can't fine tune then. But
yeah,
if you don't know where the wedge is and you haven't accidentally revealed a portion of the dial, then it can be fun to just like tinker with it a little bit before locking it in. On the whole, I found that when I tinker, I earn more points.
Yeah. It's like you might not want to go with your first instinct, but maybe your second or third.
Yeah, if you are going with your first instinct, you may be going too much off of your own opinion, or you may not have taken the time to consider what the extremes are and how close to the extremes this answer is.
Yeah.
Because again, like sure, a cup of coffee is hot, but it's not the hottest thing. It's not the surface of the sun, you know? So, you know, consider those extremes, take a second, and that might make you adjust the dial a little more to one way or the other than you initially would have guessed.
Especially if you're working with a team of other guessers, like, it might be good to do your first thought, but then wait and discuss that and try to see if, like, if everybody's on board with that or if, you know, going from there's any difference you could make.
Yeah, you and another person might have different ideas, so you could lock your answer in, and they might say, like, oh, I thought it would be way more to this side. Sometimes you just split the difference, and that is good enough. Is there any other strategy tips? There's, like I mentioned, there's advanced and basic cards, and I tend to go, when I draw a card, for the more interesting and the more abstract thing, because I enjoy coming up with very clever clues. But it's up to you whether you go for clever things or the more concrete concepts.
Yeah, I don't have much else to say.
I'm curious if the cards are divided where one side of the card is like a very measurable thing and the other isn't. Probably not. There's a lot of cards and a lot of different ways that the cards can direct you.
Right.
Okay. So before we go into our discussion on design, let's do a little chat about plugs. All right. So as always, you can follow us on social media at BG Broscast on Facebook and Twitter. You can hit us up with suggestions for games we should play there. We've been kind of getting a number of suggestions through our email, I think. So that's also perfectly fine. Where can people email us?
Well, on our website at bgbcast.com, we actually have a contact form.
Oh, well, there you go. So, yeah, you can feel free to fill that out. So, again, our website is bgbcast.com. We have all of our episodes posted and cataloged there. We have a cool search bar you can use to find our thoughts on any particular game. And you can use that little contact form to hit us up with suggestions if you like. On our website, you can also find a link to our TeePublic store. That's teepublic.com/user/bgbcast, where we have merch with our cool new logo on it. And that's basically it for BG Bros plugs, so let's hear some Matt plugs.
You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming, where I post things, talk about my thoughts on different stuff I'm experiencing, whether it's shows or video games or what have you. I also announce and talk about a lot of the stuff I'm working on, a lot of my projects. One of the main things is you can get a notification for when I go live on Twitch, on twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream Monday, Wednesday, Friday, sometimes Tuesday, sometimes Thursday, from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 p.m. Central Time or so. I stream a lot of roguelites, a lot of competitive games. I've been playing Miitopia, and I've recently started two new segments. One of them is on Mondays. It is called The Unpack, where I talk about a more in-depth sort of topic, do a bit more of a deep dive for a bit. And then on Fridays, I do 47 Fridays, where I play Hitman, and people in the chat can spend channel points to mess with me. So if any of that sounds interesting, check out that stream. And you can also find VODs and uploads of The Unpack on my main YouTube channel at youtube.com/IEatAtSonic. IEatAtSonic.
All right. As for me, I stream on Twitch occasionally at twitch.tv/RadicalHawks. That's twitch.tv/RadicalHawkz. I think I want to stream more Skate 2, which is something I started on stream about a week ago, and I've been itching to get back to it. So you can check that out there. You can also find me on Twitter at JeffCraigDesigns for my personal thoughts and ideas and funny tweets. And I don't know, I just like funny stuff on Twitter. And I try to say funny stuff most of the time. All right.
All right.
That does it for plugs. So let's get back into the strategy discussion.
You mean the design?
Design discussion.
So this game is pretty interestingly designed. I know you were wanting to talk about the component design. That's definitely a big standout, quite literally.
Yeah, so this game does a lot of cool things that aren't super common when it comes to board games. And I think a lot of that stems from the component design. And if you want to, we can also kind of talk about how there's really no theme to this game. You know, they claim that you're a psychic, that you're trying to link minds with your allies to get them to guess something. But that's really the extent of it, is just like one word in the game's rule book, and everything else is just extremely just very design, like visually design forward.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much abandons the theme, like the color palette. There's no illustrations. Everything is very geometric and simple and minimal, and there's nothing that really makes you think. I guess the dial is round, which evokes maybe a crystal ball, but there's nothing to it that
it's more of a gear. It's not a complete circle.
I know, but I'm just saying, if you were to try to make a connection to the theme of being a psychic,
sure,
you know, maybe you could connect that the dial is sort of like a crystal ball, even though, yeah, it's got like notches for you to help turn it, and nothing really crystal looking to indicate anything else. It's very, very visually design forward, graphic design forward, which I personally enjoy. So because of that, their components have to be pretty good, especially the dial itself. Like the game would be unplayable if the dial was impossible to work with or difficult to work with. So it makes sense that they hired a product designer and credit her on the box. And I think for the most part, the product turned out very, very good.
Right. Yeah.
It's solid plastic construction. The notches, like that I mentioned earlier, prevent there from being any ambiguous results.
It also helps it guessing. Not get bumped when you're moving the handle.
Yeah, exactly. Now we did start to encounter, like, sometimes if you're not careful when you reveal the answer, you can accidentally bump the wheel a couple notches. But it doesn't go like flying in any direction too far. It's only ever a couple notches off from where it was. And honestly, I mean, when I really think about it, like, we tried to correct it every time we bumped it a little bit. But when I really think about it, you know, it might make the difference of 1 or 2 points. That doesn't really bother me in the grand scheme of things. Like,
yeah,
everything is so abstract, like where the wedge ended up and where the person's guess ended up, that, you know, even if they're close, that's fine. Like, a couple ticks isn't gonna really, like, you wouldn't say a different clue if it was like 2 or 3 ticks in any direction, most likely.
Right.
The plastic construction is very solid. The notches are nice. The handle that manipulates the window sticks out far enough that you're most likely not going to hit the dial. And then they use color pretty well to help, you know, explain what something does. Like the red knob that you turn to adjust the handle for your guests sticks out. You know, generally in design and art, red is a color that really sticks out from other colors and is used to like draw the eye and draw the attention. So it makes sense that they use red on the most important component when it comes to locking in your guests. They use white for the dial, which helps the wedge stand out when you peek at it, so you don't have to like study it too hard and maybe give away where the answer is. For, you know, the yellow, red, and blue wedges that show where the points are, you don't have to like narrow your gaze to figure out where it is. You can see it at a glance. And then the structure itself is like dark green and the window is light green. So those sort of blend together, which makes it so that the red knob stands out even further, especially because red is the contrasting color to green.
Yeah.
Also, so yeah, very, very smart visual design for the component.
Also, I do like that the 2 and 3 are kind of close together color wise. It's like a yellow and orange, but then mm-hmm. the 4 is like this blue, which helps that really give it some significance and pop out. Mm-hmm.
It also helps when it's close to between 3 and 4, because the red will sort of blend into the reddish-orange 3 wedge, but if it's anywhere in the blue 4 wedge, it will stand out a little bit more.
Right.
And so, I enjoy that the wedge is on both sides of the wheel, so no matter how much you spin it, some of that wedge is always going to be visible in the upper area. There is just only a rare occasions. You don't often have to re-spin it when 4 is cut off. It doesn't happen very often, which I enjoy.
Yeah. So the other sort of parts of the box, like the point tracker is built in, the card slot where you put the card that you're using is built in. Mm-hmm. There's even a little slot for this pencil that's like the turn tracker. All of those have their own spots. They're wedged in enough that you can see them, but yeah. They also stick out well. The box is blue, but those components are all warm colors like orange and yellow.
Right. And we're talking about a plastic vacuum formed box insert that holds everything together. So not only does it hold pieces in place for when the box is closed and packed away, but also it has these like stands, these notches for standing up cards and other cardboard components built into the box insert. Mm-hmm. And it also has a slot that holds the dial upright. And the plastic insert is thick enough and rigid enough that it can hold everything perfectly fine. There's a big open bin at the back of the box to hold the rule book, and also that has a little spot to place discarded cards if you'd like to throw them there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's sort of a thing for every or a place for everything in this box for storage and for gameplay use. And the end result with this box design with the insert combined with the components is that this game doesn't need any table space. It doesn't have to spread anything out on the table or put anything outside of the box. Everything is always contained within the boundaries of the box that it comes in, which is very unique for board game design.
It's super helpful because you can pass the box around. So like the person who is the psychic, they turn it to they turn it to face them. They look at it, they set the thing and all that. Then they can turn it around. The other members of the team can like pull it closer to them to look at it. You can have it face other people. And the other cool thing about the handle is that it lets the psychic reveal the answer without them looking at it.
Right,
so they can like
the handle,
show it to them like a game show host.
Because the handle extends off of the edge of the wheel, yeah, the psychic can manipulate that handle to open the window and reveal the answer from behind the dial, which, yeah. Yes, is very, very convenient.
I will say that even though like the point tracker is short, if you wanted to reset when you got to the end, it's immediate. Like there's no mm-hmm. setup or takedown between games of the game.
Right. We've used code names as an example because it draws a lot of parallels gameplay wise. But it couldn't be more different setup wise because it takes like you said, zero time to set up. You maybe have to shuffle one deck of cards and then put it back where you found it, but that's it. And yeah, the game's just ready to go immediately. When the game's over, it takes no time to set up the next round. And the clue givers do not have to stand in any particular place to give their clues. They can sit right where they are. You know, you can sit with either team on either side of a table. You can alternate players like a game of like fishbowl or something like you would there. So that you just pass the game component around in a circle. You don't have to get up. I think there's a lot of accessibility concerns that are tackled really well with this concept of like everything being contained and passable and locked in place with this box.
One other graphic design thing not related to the box that I love is that the cards, they don't have a card border. The only main exception would be the advanced cards, which have this sort of column in the very middle that denotes them as being advanced. But what that does is that the main colors of the cards bleed over to the sides. But in turn, that lets you separate which ones are advanced cards from regular cards just from the sides of the cards.
Right. You can look at the side of the deck of cards and you can tell very clearly where the advanced cards are located because their border is, it has that little space in the middle where it says advanced, that little strip in the middle is visible on the side of the cards.
Yeah, usually card borders help with that reducing bleed so that there's like more anonymity, I guess, between cards. You can't identify them based on the spine. I guess spine isn't quite the word, but with this, it works in its favor because you can easily separate the advanced cards from the regular cards whether or not you want to use them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really shuffle them together, but I think that's fine in the end for, you know, like you could just alternate, you could choose, you could, you know, there's a lot of options you have.
Yeah. So talking more about the visual graphic style of this game, I think it goes a very minimalist approach. There's pretty much no illustrations except for you can maybe call the box art, the artwork on the front of the box an illustration. It shows like two head silhouettes with sort of these like kind of 70s radiating lines crisscrossing and overlapping in the center with wavelength in the middle. The color palette is pretty wild. It goes all over the place, but all of the colors still feel like they're in very much the same sort of family and have the same tone and feel to them.
Right. They're not very saturated. Not quite pastels, though.
No. They still have some darkness to them, some depth. But they do have sort of a muted feeling for most of them. But they have a whole spectrum of colors, orange, yellow, blue, green. Every card takes two of the colors from the game's color palette. And uses them as backgrounds for either half of the card, which denotes the two ends of the spectrum. And then it has a copy on top of it. I mentioned earlier, there is some consideration, at least maybe potentially, for accessibility in that you don't have to stand up and walk around the table to play this game. You can just sit at the table in one place and pass the game around, which is nice. But there is a bit of a readability issue with some of the cards where they've stretched the color palette, I think, a little too far, and they put dark text on one of their darker colors, and it makes it a little hard to read, especially across from the table. At least luckily, you can easily pass the game box to somebody if they're having trouble reading it, and hopefully up close they can see it if that's something necessary. The wedges, at least, are easy to identify, so it's not hard to see the points.
Right.
I talked about the compulsion to grab the wrong handle, but I think they did everything in their power to stop you from doing that.
Yeah, I think I'm just bad at remembering not to grab it.
I mean, I've done it too. It's just, yeah, you just have to kind of be careful about that.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to talk about how the clean graphic design, just like the simple two-color palette, the simple appearance of the dial, the box being intriguing but not illustrative, and you know, it's a departure from kind of typical board game box art design where you put like a big illustration of what your game is about. You put a lot of the theme in the artwork, have like a lot of fancy illustrations. I like the difference. It makes the game definitely stand out on the shelf amongst other games. I don't know, it probably appeals to a broader audience. I don't know if there's any market research to suggest that, but I would assume that a game with this more like minimalist graphic designy appearance would appeal more large to an audience that maybe has opinions on fantasy and history and sci-fi.
Right. Yeah, it's a pretty like mass market wide appeal type thing by it being more abstract.
A Target shelf.
Exactly.
And it would still stand out there. It's hard. Yeah. Board games at Target have very good box art, I must say.
They have to.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the cards. Okay. I feel like this game kind of really runs the gamut of like understandable cards to just completely out there. I think there's sort of a quantity issue where when you need a lot of components for a game, you kind of really have to push yourself sometimes, especially because they separated them by regular and advanced.
Mm-hmm.
There's at least one that isn't necessarily explicit inherently, but it's definitely not one I would play like with kids that we got, that somebody drew in our last time we played. But it was like one out of maybe 30 or 20 that we did that day. But even then, there's a lot of like, you'll have your kind of basic ones like hot and cold or, you know, mean or nice. But then you have like action movie or adventure movie. And there's a lot that feel like it feels like they just took a lot of like things that are either similar or opposites. But then they started kind of mixing them together, I guess. I don't know what I'm trying to say, I guess. But, like, I think this game would have done better with either, I don't know, more writers or more crunching some of the cards out.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there are some cards that don't feel like they fit with the other cards. Like, there's a very, sure, very wide range of these cards.
Sure, maybe it's more editing, maybe it's making sure, assumed earlier, that the front of every card is a measurable thing that's not up to interpretation, and the back of the card could input some measure of opinion. And then, yeah, maybe considering, you know, adding to the advanced category some things that might be more appropriate for an older audience versus a younger audience. They suggest the age of this game is 14 and up. So okay. I guess there is that, like there is, it's sort of like a PG or a rated T game, board game wise, which is kind of interesting that they have this sort of broad visual appeal to the game, but it's meant for a more mature audience. I guess it maybe takes a more mature sensibility to see like a very beautiful box art like this and appreciate it for what it is versus like seeing very colorful characters or something jumping across it.
I think some of it is that because they had to push themselves for like so many different cards, there are just some topics that are hard to find nuance for unless you're really, I don't know, unless you've seen a lot, I guess.
Sure.
Like action movie versus adventure movie. I kind of get what they're saying with but I don't know.
Nerd versus geek.
Yeah, I don't know if 9-year-old me would have understood that.
Sure. So the age range, I think, is spot on for the cards that come with the game. I could see that there's definitely some room for improvement or just recategorization.
That being said,
to appeal a little bit or make it a little bit easier to understand in some ways.
That being said,
it's a good start to have the advanced side of the deck.
I would love to see a Super Fight styled like theme packs for this game.
Sure.
You know, I think if you got people together with like if the action adventure movie was in like a movie pack for people who like movies, like there's a lot of room for something like that I think would be interesting. I think part of what I love about this game is that the cards are just good conversation starters. I was joking that like, you could make a whole podcast about just discussing these cards. And I think to me, I enjoy more talking about them with the other players than I do being forced to come up with a clue for them. Because I think there is a lot of interesting like spectrums that I've never really thought about, but it's hard to put that by yourself and figure out what to actually say by yourself.
Yeah, I think one thing that this game has in spades that you and I appreciate in a party game is that it is like a conversation starter. And it does have time built into it for people to talk about the game without interrupting play. Like, because it's two teams, while one team's psychic is giving their clue or considering their clue, or while the other team is just considering their answer, your team can talk about the clue that you just went through and like what you might put as the extremes or what clue you would have given. And honestly, I don't ever feel bad when my team comes up with a better clue. I feel like kind of a sense of satisfaction if my teammates can think of a clue that would have better illustrated where the wedge was than the clue I had given. It's like, oh yeah, that one sounds good. That's a good one. Good idea. And even then, like after you're done playing the game, we found ourselves still considering answers for cards we drew or cards we didn't draw, but we had seen in the game. Like even the next day we were like, oh, I just thought of a great word for where the spectrum was for this card that we drew.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely a good, you know, indictment of the game, or I guess indictment isn't the right word. That's a positive. That's a big plus for this game.
Endorsement?
An endorsement. There you go. That's exactly the word I was thinking of. That's a shining endorsement for a party game like this. It keeps you talking even after the game is done being played.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it helps that the game has that conversation time sort of built into it unintentionally.
Yeah, I would love to play this game with more players than we have.
Yeah, we've played it with kind of small groups, but this can be, the game says it's a playable up to 12 plus players. You can, as long as you have, even if you don't have an even number, you can play with any number of players.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, because the game can be passed around, it's easy to do. I'm assuming there's a maximum limit. At least it would be hard for everyone to get their hand on the game or to pitch their idea for where the dial is or see the result, you know.
But yeah.
I guess the limit to this game is the size of your table. And that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, you don't have to have a small enough or a big enough table. That's not to say you don't need to have a big enough table like other games. This game, you can have any size table, just an extremely large one will suit more players.
Okay, you need the table to be a little more than the size of the box.
You don't really even need a table, though. You could just kind of sit this box in your lap and pass it around. The box isn't heavy at all. Like, the components aren't that heavy, so you can easily pass it lap to lap, you know?
Yeah.
It would be hard for other people to move the dial from, like, across the room, but I guess maybe in that case, the psychic could manipulate the dial for its team, and they could just say more to one side or the other, you know, two ticks to the right, one tick to the left, that's where it should go.
Sure.
Sometimes the clue giving can take a while with this game, just because it allows so much wiggle room for what to say. I think that maybe that's a component that leads to, and also just some of the cards are a little hard to interpret, especially when it comes to like what's in the middle, the dead center, like underrated actor, overrated actor is the spectrum. What does the middle mean?
I guess that means they're rated actor.
Appropriately rated actor. Even then, that's kind of a hard one to come up with.
Leonardo
ideas
DiCaprio.
For. Is he really though? I'm not sure. So, yeah, some of the cards, they can be a little vague and hard to understand. Of course, it's up to the clue giver to choose what the card is. So, you know, if you don't think you can come up with a dozen or so clues on any part of the spectrum, but when you select a card, you probably shouldn't have selected it. But it is a little bit bold that the game doesn't include a timing device to prevent the clue giver from taking way too long and being too, you know, specific with their clue.
This is interesting because a lot of times when playing party games like this, we'll ignore the timer they bring in. But sure. This is a time where, like, I kind of want to have a timer, so I'm forced to say something.
Yeah.
Or else sometimes I'm afraid I'll go on forever.
Yeah, so it's bold that the game doesn't include that, but it's fine that it does. I think overall the game is aided by the fact that you can be so specific and take so long to think and say something that's more than just a single word.
Right, I definitely feel really good when I get, like, a really good idea for a word.
Yeah.
I think even if my team doesn't guess it quite right, I'm still pretty happy because I've been able to puzzle together something.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe, like, if I don't guess right and they had a really clever word, I'll appreciate it after seeing their answer or the clue that they gave, you know, where the wedge was.
So I have one last question for you if you're done talking about strategy or the design portion of this game. And my question is, Does this, because I think before playing this game, I think Codenames was kind of like my shining example of an excellent party game that blends, you know, design, creativity, and conversation. Does this game take the place in your mind of like the archetypical, like well-designed party game?
I think so. Codenames has a lot of clunkiness to it with like setup.
I think
especially.
This game, the existence of this game, like, highlights some of Codenames' pitfalls, especially in the things that aren't related to the game's design, but more the components of the game and the game setup.
I think Codenames isn't as much of a conversation starter. I would say, like, Super Fight or something like that would be closer. And it, even in that case, I think Wavelength is more approachable than Super Fight, which kind of trends to the nerdy end.
Sure, and it also doesn't force you to argue with anybody.
Yeah.
And you only have to be very creative and improvisational when it's your turn to be the psychic. And at least you've had the ability to choose what spectrum you are giving a clue on.
Right. I think the fact that we're still talking about questions we've gotten or cards we've drawn shows that this is a really good conversation starter.
Yep.
And I think that's, like you said, a good goal to aim for when making a party game. Mm-hmm. Is how can you add to the party, not become the party?
All right. So
I'm enough of a party myself.
Of course. So yeah, I think that ends our discussion on what could potentially be our new favorite party game ever made, Wavelength. So thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. See you later.
We will see you next episode when we discuss another game.